I wanted to start this episode off just with a quick moment to celebrate the life of James Earl Jones, who passed away last week at the age of 93. Obviously, one of the most celebrated actors of the past 60 years at this point, with his performances dating back to Stanley Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove. Of course, listeners of this podcast will know him as the elderly neighbor at the end of The Sandlot, who all of the kids are so afraid of, as well as, of course, the man that Kevin Costner tracks down in Field of Dreams. You know, one of the true titans of baseball cinema, as well as, of course, the obvious role everybody knows him for, Darth Vader. You know, when you click on one of our episodes, James Earl Jones' voice is the first thing you hear. You know, he starts off the intro to our show. If you haven't watched one of those movies in a few years, you know, go give Field of Dreams or The Sandlot a spin. Yeah.
I have a feeling everybody in our audience, which is a combo of baseball and movie fans we expect, has seen those, but
you gotta think so, right? It's been a little bit at this point, but the last time that we put out an episode was right as he passed, so I didn't get a chance to mention it then, but I definitely wanted to be able to commemorate him. It is an important figure in baseball history and cinematic history as well. Rest in peace to James Earl Jones. We will truly miss you.
Somewhere men are laughing, and somewhere children shout, but there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck!
I only got one thing to say to you. Strike this brother out.
2-2. He got it! A perfect game ever done by the King!
Hey, you! Are you right in that boat?
Took away a game-tying home run for Manny Ramirez.
That's my mistake, fellas.
We will see you tomorrow.
Ladies and gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for visiting us this evening.
We also put out the podcast saying the Yankees hadn't called up Jason Dominguez right as the Yankees called up Jason Dominguez.
We do that a lot.
I know. It seems to happen.
It's,
I guess,
really unfortunate.
You know, it's almost like that is the lay of the land when you podcast about something that changes as quickly as Major League Baseball does, especially at time when we're seeing so many young players come up and join their big league clubs. You know,
I also think Yankee fans fully bullied the front office into calling Jason Dominguez. So I really don't think they were planning on doing that. And then Twitter got loud enough that the bald man had to respond.
I talked about it myself on the episode last week of just how frustrating it was that they hadn't called him up and were playing just an obviously inferior player in Alex Verdugo. But they have righted that wrong, gotten quite a bit of a lead now in the American League East, thanks to the Baltimore Orioles falling off. So it looks like the hesitation to call up Dominguez might not end up proving as costly as it could have, which is good news for the New York Yankees. But we will get into all of that. We've got a very fun episode for you today to talk about some of the divisional races. Brody Goes Hollywood sees his name on the big screen for the first time. So we've got quite a lot to talk about this week. This is the Mudville Podcast, and I'm one of your hosts, Nolan Rabine.
I am your other host, Hollywood Joe, Brody Stout, apparently.
And Brody, not only have you just gone Hollywood, you also just got back from a long trip to Europe, which I'm sure listeners of the pod would love to hear from you, because it's been a little bit.
Yeah, as Hollywood as I've been, it gets deeper to the point that is actually hilarious. The reason that this is all a joke, by the way, for the audience, I'm not Hollywood in the slightest.
Yeah, we say that
however,
very
tongue-in-cheek. However, I accidentally ended up at the Venice Film Festival, and a week later saw my name in the credits of a movie that I worked on. So it was a cool couple weeks. We were planning a trip to Venice and planning a trip to London. I'd started a new job a few months ago, and girlfriend and I had been talking a lot about wanting to get away at some point, and it was a good time finally to be able to do that. So we took a couple weeks and traveled for a little bit. It was fantastic. But when we got to Venice, we realized that we were there at the exact same time that the Venice Film Festival was going on. Like, there was this kind of excitement around the city. It was like really busy. It was a beautiful place, by the way. I would highly recommend a visit at some point. Although if you do, it has the issues of it being a very small city that is often inundated daily with a lot of tourists. And it is kind of sad how the locals don't really have a place that's theirs anymore. Like, we were staying with a host who we talked to a lot, and she was saying how, like, we were trying to ask for like a restaurant recommendation, like, that isn't something that's like that touristy. And she said that the Venetians don't know where to go anymore. Like, those were her words, because it's all just overrun basically all the time by tourists because it's not a huge city. So that was a little depressing. And they're like trying to combat it. There's like, they've thought of different ways. I would think of charging like entry fees, but it's just kind of like that aspect of it is kind of depressing, but it is beautiful and it is really cool to see, but it is, you know, it's not without its issues. Overall, it was a cool experience to be able to go there. And then we went to Scotland, we went to London, which are two of my favorite places, went to Edinburgh in Scotland. So it was just overall great time to be away. And while we were in Venice, actually, this is what I meant. During the film festival, we were standing outside of a little like wine bar early in the morning, and they have like these water taxis all over the city. And the taxis are really expensive compared to like the water bus that they have that goes around the city. Like the taxis, it's, you know, a lot like the city where like New York, where like you can get around by subway. And if you want to take a cab, it's more expensive because you're going to a specific place, except it's like way more expensive for a taxi compared to the public transit in Venice. So like, you know, it's like 120 euros or something to take a taxi instead of like the 9 euros that it is to take the water bus. And you can also walk everywhere. But anyway, so
public transit for the win.
Yeah, exactly. Public transit for the win, obviously, all the time. But there was this taxi that came like flying up the canal that we were standing next to. We were like eating breakfast. And all these people around us pull out their phones and they're like starting to like record, and they're like whispering. There's like a hush that comes over like the crowd. And they're like, oh my God, is that, do you see that? And like there was this, you know, obviously like movie star looking dude standing on the back of the like the back of the boat is like open, like, and you can like stand on it. And it was like short hair, sunglasses, nice coat, like waving to people. And it was like Kevin Costner, who just came like in a taxi, like zipping up the water, and he waved, and somebody yelled, "No Way Out is my favorite movie. I love you." And he just, he goes, "Was I in that?" And then the taxi sped away and went down the other way. And it was just this really cool little moment. But yeah, it was great. It was overall just cool to be away for a little bit and had some fun. Saw Kevin Costner. Good 2 weeks. But how you doing?
How's
things in the homeland?
Keeping things tidy for you until you got back. You didn't get to see any films at the Venice Film Festival while you were there?
I did not. We were kind of mostly just doing some traveling. We weren't really over at the actual film festival itself, because I think you'd have to buy expensive tickets to have gone in. But we were, it's also like in Lido, like not the city of Venice, which we were in the city.
Sure.
Lido
sure,
is
sure.
Like kind of.
I can relate to that experience. As last time I was in Toronto was in June of 2019, right as the Raptors were winning the NBA championship. And I would have loved to have.
Accidentally in a moment.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I would have loved to have like commemorated that in some way, or to have been like Ben in the like parade or the rallies or whatever. To have gone to one of the games would have been phenomenal, but nothing really like that happened. I could just sort of say that I was in the area when it happened, which I guess is significantly less cool. But it sounds like you had a phenomenal time in Europe and a great trip. Super happy for you. Glad you're back. We're coming at you on Sunday, September 22nd here. We're getting into some of the biggest times around sports of the year. Some of the most important events of the year are going down right now. If you're a fantasy sports player like me, these past 3 weeks might have been a complete whirlwind as the fantasy baseball playoffs have coincided with the first 3 weeks of the football season, as they always do. I consider it a bit of an Armageddon type feeling, which brings a lot of anxiety into my life every year, but it can also bring the glory if you're lucky. So if you're one of those people out there, I hope your fantasy baseball season ended with a championship, or at least with some sort of satisfaction for you. And if you're into football, keep your chin up. It might be over for Bryce Young, but it's not over for you. Brody, why don't we get into some of this baseball, starting with, of course, what else could we possibly talk about other than the Thursday night performance?
Ernie Clement.
Love to talk about Ernie Clement, dude. I love the fringe Toronto Blue Jays infielders, dude. Davis Schneider. Spencer Horowitz.
Hey, David Schneider grew out his beard. He's throwing away his branding. I don't understand it. He's a mustache guy.
Well, we'll talk about the Jays next week, because for now we've got to mention the unbelievable performance put on by Shohei Ohtani on Thursday night in Miami. 6 for 6 at the plate, 3 home runs, 2 doubles, 10 RBI. 17 total bases. I'd like to go through his at-bats one by one here, just so everyone can fully understand how completely insane this was. All right? Follow along here with me. Shohei Ohtani leads off Thursday evening in the top of the first, doubles off the wall in right center. First at-bat of the game, almost a home run, doubles off the wall, ended up missing, tying the all-time record of 4 home runs in one game, held by very many by just a few feet. He immediately steals third base. Probably shouldn't have made it. Throw beat him, but an elusive slide evaded the tag, and he got into third, his 50th steal of the season. Second inning, he comes up again, singles to right, and drives in a run. He then steals second base again for number 51. Third inning, he comes up again, so his third at-bat already, doubles into the gap, drives in 2 runs, and gets thrown out trying to stretch it into a triple. So, to recap, in case you couldn't get all that, we're 3 innings into this game. Ohtani has doubled twice, he added a single on top of that, he's driven in 3 runs and stolen 2 bases. Third inning. Sixth inning, he comes up with a man on second and just hits an absolute fucking tank. Nukes a baseball that landed in a spot maybe 5 people on the planet can hit it to, but Shohei just happens to be one of those people. So add a 2-run home run to that total I just mentioned. And at this point in the game, I'm like, surely that's the end, right? I, at this point, had left work. I'd gone out to a bar. So I was like looking up at the ticker at this point, and I was like, there's no way. He's going to, like, that has to be the end. Someone's going to take their foot off the gas here. Probably not Ohtani himself, but, like, Dave Roberts is going to pull him from the game, or Skip Schumacher is just going to walk him, or somebody's going to put a stop to this. I mean, he can't continue
Skip Schumacher
doing...
apparently was very against that.
I'm
going
to get to that, yeah. Big Skip Schumacher guy after this weekend. But seventh inning, he comes up again, also with a runner on second, bit of deja vu, and he homers again, this time to the opposite field, and this is number 50. This is the one that created the 50-50 club. No one had ever hit 50 home runs and stolen 50 bases in the same season up until this very moment. I see the notification pop up, and I think this has to be a mistake. They have to have put 50 when they meant 49. There is no way he got up to the plate again already, let alone hit another home run, but he did. Ninth inning comes around. Runners on second and third. Dodgers up 14-3. Shohei Ohtani comes up to the plate again. There was no need to even send him up to the plate here. Surely if he was a position player in the field, he would have been pulled long ago in this game. But they send him up back to the plate. And I want to give a shout out here to Tipping Pitches, one of my favorite baseball podcasts, who posted a video that I believe went viral, but that a camera in the stadium was able to capture of Marlins manager Skip Schumacher, who must have been asked while the camera was on him about walking Ohtani, because you can clearly read his lips. He says, "I've got too much fucking respect for this guy to let that happen." So just fire me up, Skip Schumacher. I mean, this is when baseball is at its best, is when, I don't want to say that, you know, a purpose of a bad team is to allow another team's players to have moments like the one Shohei Ohtani did on Thursday. It does sort of drive me crazy when a team is down like 10-3 or something, and the manager gets really defensive about the other team's players still like trying to play or like trying to win or score more runs in that game. On one hand, I always tend to think, get better. You don't like it, pitch better. I mean, especially for a moment like this, there are a lot of guys who their pride, their ego would dominate this moment, and they would say, this guy has done enough. We're not going to let him hurt us anymore. We're just going to send him to first base and give him the free pass. Skip Schumacher did not do that. Ohtani came up 5 for 5 on the day, position player on the mound, and he came right at him. He said, pitch him the ball. Ohtani hits a moonshot into the seats for his third home run of the day. Brody, he had such a good game that his gambling controversy is being relitigated again on social media. And that's just simply impressive.
This game was absolutely nuts. I think now would probably be a good time as any. Like, I have sort of hinted to the fact that I've been, like, you know, I had this job or whatever. I watch baseball for it. I work for the MLB Network. It's not a huge deal. But it's, there are moments that are cooler than others to work there. And at this moment, I was downstairs in our edit room, and we can hear the control room of the Dodgers and the Marlins on the phones, because this game was on the entire room. The people who were working on it put it on a speaker, and the entire room gets up and is watching this game. And somebody just goes, "Well, we'll know if we hear the control room, because they'll have it first." And we're all like, "Yeah, that's a good point, I guess. So we'll just, you know, we'll keep watching." And right before a pitch comes in, we just hear from the control room, "Holy fuck, he did it!" And we were like, "Oh shit!" And then, and then the swing comes in. And then, you know, it was really cool. It was a really cool moment. The whole place went nuts. Honestly, it was like, it was one of the cooler things that I've, you know, been a part of while working there. So that was exciting. And I also have to say, if you are just now becoming a big Skip Schumacher guy, part of my gig is to watch manager interviews and, like, you know, write about what they say or something, basically along those lines. And he gives great answers. Like, I've been a huge fan of the way that he talks in post-game interviews this whole season, because his team has not been very good, but they do have a lot of young talent, and he constantly is like, you know, he gives them support in the way that's not Boone-esque in just saying, like, everybody's amazing and they're the best on the planet at what they do, but also just saying, like, we believe in them, and this is, like, you know, like, it's, you know, they're here for a reason. Like, they do this well. This is what we need to improve on. He gives great answers. I feel like he's a good man for the job down there in Miami. But this was a cool moment. And when stars are allowed to be stars, like, we constantly see Aaron Judge having the bat taken out of his hands. You know, today, actually, Bobby Witt got walked to load the bases when the Royals were down 2 in the ninth, like, with, you know, with 2 on, and it would have been an awesome moment where he could have come up and did something cool, and instead bases loaded for Salvador Perez with 2 outs and, you know, inning over, basically game over. Like, it's just, it's frustrating that that is such a prevalent thing in baseball, that it's good strategy, which is a problem, but also they need to get rid of the automatic walk. That is a thing that I really feel strongly about now, and I know people are indifferent about it, but I think it just sucks the drama. At least you still get 4 pitches. Like, there's something to that of seeing them be a wimp and, you know, throw around them 4 times. You know, the crowd gets to boo. It's not as, like, annoying as just seeing them walk sadly down to first base and the manager throw up his 4 fingers like a little lame, you know, lame duck. But that was a really cool moment, and I'm extremely impressed by Shohei Ohtani, obviously. There is a lot of talk about it being the best game ever played. I don't know where you stand on that. But if you want to try to get into that really quick, I don't know. Like, it's an interesting argument. I think just the fact that it's for a club that is so ridiculously, like, lofty is it adds some panache. But I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I was wondering about that. I mean, I know I saw some people asking that question, and so naturally I started thinking, like, you know, what are some other all-time individual performances that I could stack this up against? Like, the first thing that came to mind was when Scooter Jeanette hit 4 home runs in 1 game. I mean, yep, you know, like I said, that's a record.
I thought
held
of Don Larson's perfect game, but you can think of Scooter Jeanette. That's fine.
sure. Well, that raises a lot of questions too about, you know, comparing offensive achievements to pitching achievements, but right, you know, it was right. Definitely like recency bias for me, because, you know, like 20 guys have hit 4 home runs in a game before.
Sure.
Jeanette is just like, I think he's the most recent example, you know, maybe somebody else did it. But
Fernando Tatis is 2 grand slams in 1 inning. That's a good one.
I know a kid, like, Chandler Simpson, did it in the minors, but I don't think anybody in Major League Baseball has done it since Scooter Jeanette. So I don't know. Like, if you compare that to Ohtani's game, it's like, would you rather have that 4th home run or 2 doubles, a single, and 2 stolen bases? I mean, like, I don't know, because then you're just sort of quantifying, like, one thing against another. I think another thing that would go into it would be, like, you know, if you take those stat lines of, you know, guys who hit 4 home runs in a game or hit 3 home runs and then got a couple other hits on top of that, you know, maybe take the, like, individual moments, like, was the team, like, was it still like a close game, and then he came up in a big spot, and then his third home run of the game, like, won the game. I mean, in like a big game for that team, you know, I think in a situation like that, I might be slightly more inclined to go with something like that. But I mean,
what about Reggie Jackson's three homer in the World Series? Like, I mean, that's
absolutely. I think you have a case to say that would top this. I mean, you know, will we be talking about this performance in 30 years the way we talk about Mr. October? I mean, probably not. I mean, that kind of depends on the rest of Ohtani's career, I think. Like, you know, I expect by the time that he retires, he'll have a bunch of moments where he, like, does something insane to, like, win a World Series or hits three home runs in consecutive games in October. Like, I mean, right now, the moment I think of for Ohtani, and I think everybody across the world should think of, is the moment where he struck out Trout in the World Baseball Classic to win it for Japan.
That was ridiculous.
It was amazing. Yeah, it was amazing. So, like, yeah, ultimately, I think this will be among those things for him, but yeah, I definitely cannot think of a performance where I'm just off the top of my head like, oh yeah, that was definitively better than what we saw from Ohtani. And that is an unbelievable context to put in a performance in a sport that's been around for over 100 years.
So I also just want to use this as a quick little tangent on the state of baseball really quick, because I feel like for a long time baseball has been needing players like this, because for about, I don't know, since like really since kind of A-Rod and Jeter retired and Ortiz, I guess, it didn't have these recognizable superstars for a while. I know Mike Trout is like the best ever, and Bryce Harper was, you know, Bryce Harper just wasn't this. Like, peak Bryce Harper was not this. He wasn't Aaron Judge. He was very good. He's a, you know, a great, great player, superstar, but he's just not. He's not setting records. He's not becoming like an all-time player. You know, he's going to be a very good player, going to be Hall of Famer, but he, you know, him and Trout are not the same as what Judge and Ohtani have done in the last 5 years. And just at a place where basketball had a lot of superstars that were doing crazy things, like, you know, Curry and LeBron, like going back to back in the finals for 3 straight years. Football has the national attention all the time. I feel like baseball is in a very good place right now, honestly, just because of the fact that you have these very recognizable stars on very marketable teams doing insane things that have never been done before. So I know I don't usually like the health of the game conversation, but I do feel like baseball is in a good spot right now with these guys. And I feel like there's also more on the way. I feel like there's a lot of super talent that's coming. But what I was thinking too with it, like once this happened, I was like, is there going to be another kid that is there going to be a time in the near future where there's like 5 Ohtanis, like where there, because it's like, you know, obviously no one had ever done it before, but now maybe teams are going to be willing to let the pitcher who can kind of hit a little bit more. Maybe they get better at both. Like, it's, he is so good that there are going to be teams that are going to be desperate to try to recreate it if they think that it's possible. So like, maybe it is possible, and you know, maybe we'll end up in a place in a few years where there's like a team or two, or a few teams that have like a guy like this, that, you know, could be kind of fun.
I like wonder that all the time now, because we're already starting to see, I think, more guys that are ostensibly two-way players coming into the draft than we have in a while. Like, you know, just from this past year, Jack Caglione was the big one coming out of Florida, but like Connor Griffin, the top high school prospect, he's both hitter and pitcher. I believe it's the same with Bryce Rainier, who those two were kind of like the top two prep bats coming into the draft. Carson Benji was a two-way player. I mean, last year, Bryce Eldridge came into the draft, like, technically as both a hitter and pitcher.
How was he not in the majors, by the way?
Well, the Giants kind of said, fuck that, you're going to be a hitting prospect. And then this year, he turned into one of the very best hitting prospects in the game.
He's so good. Yeah, so in on him for next year.
I mean, you know.
Oh, my God.
For next time I do a prospect ranking or discussion or anything, I mean, he's instantly in the top 10. He has turned everything on this year in a way that very few prospects
like
have.
He's unreal. Every time I see a highlight of his, I'm blown away.
He's really great.
Crazy.
So yeah, I mean, I think we're definitely going to kind of, I think we're going to see people maybe kind of like entertain that, but like ultimately Shohei is such a singular player that I think like the best thing that we're going to see like in comparison to him might be like a guy who like hits very well and then comes out of the bullpen a couple times to like
That's
throw like a like Nolan McLain type for the Mets right now in the minors. He kind of does that.
But he's so good at both.
Exactly.
It's not fair. Yeah. He is, if he was a bad pitcher, it would still be unbelievable what he's doing.
Yes.
He's a great pitcher. And he closed out the World Baseball Classic by striking out Mike Trout. He could have won a Cy Young a couple years ago. And like, it's frustrating. It's frustrating how good he is because it's like impossible to actually appreciate and talk about how good he is.
Well, that,
like,
that's
because it's like you can't do it. You can't. There's no lens for discussing how good he actually is because he's like so beyond what we've seen.
That's exactly where I was going to go with this, is it's like, how do you even talk about this player? Because you can't even say at this point that there's nothing left to say and that he's just beyond words, because like that has been the conversation for so long. Like, I remember we said the exact same thing about him like last year when we were giving out awards and talking about like the best players in the game. It's like nobody can do what he does, and nobody has done what he's done for so long, where we just had that 3-year stretch where he was both one of the best hitters and pitchers in baseball at all times and stayed healthy through that span. Now we're in a year where he's only at the plate and he's decided to become like just the best hitter on the planet, like
ever,
to create
a
new
club. He's going to be the first DH to ever win the MVP.
Yeah.
Think about that.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Alone.
Unbelievable.
He just decided to become the best hitter. Like, the crazy thing is if he was in the American League, I still think Judge would win the MVP over him. But like, it's just absurd. He can just turn this on and do what he does. There is also a defense aspect. There's nobody close in the National League, I think, where they would be able to go at him for the MVP.
Mets fans talking about Francisco Lindor. No, I'm sorry.
No. I mean, like, it's not insignificant. I mean, like, there's a argument for it because Lindor is a very good shortstop, but it's still just not close enough. Like,
nothing against Lindor.
Ridiculous.
One bit.
No, nothing against Lindor. We're talking about Otani here.
Fantastic season. One of the best.
This is not the same thing as being like, he's bad. No, Lindor's going to be a very deserved second place in the MVP behind literal baseball Jesus. Like, you got to, sometimes you can't win them all. Like, sorry.
One of the best seasons from a shortstop I can remember in a very long time. And at the same time, no, he's not an MVP.
Exactly.
Otani is.
Speaking of which, should we maybe move on to those Metsies?
I think we should, because I would like to talk about some of these divisional races. I don't have much to say about the AL East right now, other than what I mentioned about Jason Dominguez earlier, that the Yankees seem to be cruising to the division right now. I think
I'm disappointed.
Yeah, no, I want to see a little bit more like cinema from it,
I know. Well, this Orioles series is coming up. I thought was going to be like really exciting, and now it's kind of lame.
It could be, but like, that's our magic number right now is like two. I mean,
one.
I'm sorry, didn't even see one. Okay, yeah. So it's like that. That seems like it's kind of wrapped. I'm happy that playing Verdugo as much as they did, and the number of saves Clay Holmes blew didn't blow up in their face like it could have.
Incredible.
I'm happy to see that, but I'm content to just move on for now from them. The Tigers.
I will just say also with the Yankees, I like, people are going to get upset with me because I'm a biased Yankee fan. Just be careful. That's all. They're getting hot at the right time, and that's kind of all it takes. And they have the talent to do a lot of really special things, and they have the pitching. All I'm saying.
Be careful. I don't think anybody is
doubt them at your
careful.
Own peril.
I'm certainly not going to doubt the players on the team right now. I think it's better than we've seen in a long time. But that'll be for our October episode next week. I think we're going to hit you guys. Here's what I'd like to do, at least, just as a little key in. I would like to go back and look at some of our predictions from earlier in the season, like what we thought was going to happen this year. Go back in to talk about some of that, and then just like go into whatever the playoff bracket looks like, however it shapes out. So I think that's gonna be a lot of fun. But for now, let's talk about the Tigers, because I mean, holy shit, like, we did our Heat Check episode and I was like, I should not have included these guys in contenders. I thought that was a huge mistake, and then they were like, no, we got you.
Were right.
maybe they just needed somebody to believe in them, and that was somebody was us, and we called them
it's
contenders
true.
And they
Harry
said
Carpenter
you're goddamn
called me
right.
up actually after that episode aired, and he was like, yo, what's going on? What's up with this? So, yeah. Then they turned it on.
Spencer Torkelson told me that I personally inspired him to stop being a bust and start actually hitting.
Worked out very well for him. Yeah, what I liked about this run that they're on, because it's easy to talk about the pitching, because you know, like Tarik Skubal is going to win the Cy Young and good for him and everything. Defense, they're winning on defense, which is really kind of fun. Like that's you don't see that very often, that a team is actually like that good defensively, that they're, you know, they're just, you know, creating opportunities to stay in games when otherwise they wouldn't. And, you know, their offense has clicked it up enough that it's enough to, you know, win what, like 15 out of 20 or something like that. They're on like a crazy streak. So good for Detroit. Good for those Lions fans. And, you know, they were able to spill some of that magic over into baseball.
And for a team that like totally sold as well, like they barely got anything for Jack Flaherty.
Yep.
Which is crazy.
It's unbelievable. They got better.
Yeah, it really is wild. But yeah, so, I mean, it's super, super interesting too. Also the fact that they're like up a game right now. I think they're tied with KC and up a game on the Twins. But like those three teams, those three AL Central teams are currently fighting for two wild card spots because Cleveland clinched the division this week. And now maybe Seattle wants to try to contend as well. Like it's a thing now because of the expanded playoffs that we see across both leagues, a little bit less so in the NL this year, where it's kind of like one team isn't going to make it depending on who it is. Like we just tend to see kind of a glob of teams that like are almost about to make the playoffs. And it was totally intentional that the owners did that because it means that they don't have to go all in if they want to compete anymore. Exactly. Like the goal was to try to cut payroll and still be able to contend through the expanded playoffs. I'm wondering
at
this
point.
Well,
the White Sox are not adding payroll next year. They'll be, they look pretty good for next year's playoff picture.
I'm wondering at this point if it's going to start to have sort of an inverse effect on that, where so many teams are trying for one spot, that investing in the best team possible and paying players that might gain you that advantage over the field might become more lucrative than ever before, you know?
The Yankees all of a sudden look dominant because they're not a perfect team by any means, but they are much better than everybody else in the league, in the American League, I mean. And like that already, like you see the benefits of that. The Orioles completely just faded from their, you know, their contention. Like they were, and this happened, by the way, I hate to be the guy to say go check the tape, but go check the tape. I did say that I was concerned about the Orioles just kind of burning out at the end of the year because they are very young. I said this last year mainly, but this year the threat is still there, that they are so young and inexperienced with playing a full 162 and inexperienced with what it means to be in a divisional race and a playoff race and a pennant race, that they could just outplay their energy stores and just kind of burn themselves out before they actually have the before it actually matters. And it seems like that's kind of what happened last year, is they had that early exit in the playoffs, and it feels like that's kind of what's happening this year again, with them just fading before they could end up actually competing for the AL East title. They're still going to end up with the first wild card, so you don't have to worry about that if you're a Nose fan. But right now, as they sit at 3-7 in their last 10, and they still have four games up on the Tigers for the first wild card spot, and they're probably not going to be losing that. It's an interesting conversation because they were neck and neck, and now they're six games behind the Yankees.
How do you feel right now about Baltimore in comparison to some of the like AL Central teams? Like, would you take them over the Tigers, Royals, and Twins question. Right now? Like, any of those teams that you would predict to beat the kind of ice cold Orioles?
I don't know, because the Tigers right now, I mean, look, the Tigers could very, very easily be the Diamondbacks of 2024. I'm sure that's what they have written on the, not even just the whiteboards, but like on the walls of their locker room. Like, you know, they're like losing their minds probably writing it in swirlies. The Royals also have played terrible baseball. They're 2-8 in their last 10 right now. They've lost 7 straight. That is abysmal. And that's with a great performance today from Seth Lugo. They ran into Blake Snell. So all of a sudden, a 2-0 lead in the first or second inning or whatever, that's ball game. That's it. And as I mentioned earlier, they walked Bobby Witt in the ninth with the game on the line. It's just, it's so hard to predict AL Central teams because they are always like, you know, there's always one, and they just kind of go early. But the Guardians don't feel like they're going to go early this year. I'd imagine they win at least a series. The Royals have been so good all season, it's hard to actually fully doubt them. The Twins, I don't think, are going to make the playoffs. I don't think they have the pitching to do it. But the Tigers, out of nowhere, kind of worry me just in the fact that they are so confident, they're playing well, and they could become a problem if they keep this up. But I don't know. What do you think?
I completely agree with you. I'd say, obviously, on paper, Baltimore over all those teams. But playoff baseball, like we especially saw it last year, it's so much about who's hot and like who gets there at the right moment. That sometimes can be so much more.
Yeah.
It's so much more important.
The Tigers right now have the second wild card spot.
Yeah.
The Royals are the third. The Tigers were, what, 7 games under 500 like 3 weeks ago? And now they're 8 up and in second in the wild card. That's crazy. That's crazy. I mean, that is like, if you're the, you know, the Rangers or something, how do you sleep at night? Like, this is, you know, this is a pathetic showing by the reigning world champions. And like, this is, you know, baseball's a weird game, man. That's all. I think that's what it boils down to.
I think you're absolutely right.
By the way, that goes for the Mets too. I'm sorry, I just wanted to mention.
No, that's where I was going next. I was going to go to the NL. Okay. But if you think about the Mets, the D-backs, the Padres, I've got a little bit to say about Arizona, but I'll let you finish your thought first.
Well, I was just going to say the same thing goes for the Mets, because the Mets are kind of doing what the Tigers have been doing for the last 2 weeks, for about 2 months. Like, the Mets have the best record in baseball, I'm pretty sure, since like the middle of June. Wait, that's not nothing. Like, that is not small sample size. That is not like a fluke. That's not a flash in the pan. That is sustained, really good baseball. So take that as you will and be afraid of them as you should be. That being said, the Phillies still have that division, like, handedly. And the Braves can still get in their way of making the playoffs, which is hilarious. And if you're a Mets fan, I'm so sorry that you're going to have to go through this again. I have a feeling that they win that series this year, and not just because they have Ronald Acuna's brother, who apparently is a superstar in the making. I do think they win that series this year, and they actually finally make the playoffs for like the second time in 20 years or whatever it is. But the Mets are like a good team. They have a good roster. They have a good lineup. They have good pitching. They're getting good pitching from the guys that, you know, they weren't sure about. When they're all on, they can hit with the best of them. So I don't know. I'd be worried if I had to play them in the playoffs. Diamondbacks, you can talk a little bit more about them than I can, I think. And the Padres are finally just doing what they're supposed to. It's just that they're in the same division as the Dodgers.
You, I think, nailed all those teams. I was going to talk about Arizona because it seems like they might be on tap to kind of have sort of a repeat of what they did last year when they found so much postseason success and even made their way to the World Series, because they have had definitively the best offense in baseball since the All-Star break. I mean, they're having a career year from Ketel Marte, who looks like, I mean, I'd probably put him in like the top five of the NL MVP race right now, as well as the second half resurgence from Corbin Carroll, who maybe his shoulder healed in some way over the All-Star break. I'm not really sure.
Tightened up the swing.
But I mean, something turned on for him, and we started to see the results that we saw in his Rookie of the Year campaign. Again, it'll be up to the pitching for them, and I think I'm less confident than I was last year. Maybe just in Zach Gallen specifically. He hasn't had that great of a year. It's felt like the extra work from October 2023 has taken a toll on him all year. And he's the guy that you need to be able to rely on and say, we need a win. This is our guy. He's going to get us 5 innings. He might give up a couple runs because we're facing a really good offense, but he's going to keep us in a solid position to win this game on the back of our pen and our offense. He's going to get us where we need to go. And I've watched enough Gallen starts this year against good teams to be pretty hesitant about that. Like, he's had a couple starts against the Brewers as of late that have not gone well for him, and like, that's a team that they're going to be seeing. I don't know. I'm not too confident in him. On the bright side, Brandon Pfaadt is a lot more playoff ready now than he was last year, and he can eat a lot of those innings as well. Like, Merrill Kelly can get a start or two, but I mean, thinking those things to myself, like, it is the exact same situation that I feel like they were in last year, where it's just like we might see a lot of like 8-7 games out of them coming forward,
and but whether or not they win have those some games, pedigree now, yeah, and you know, the ability to fight through that. There is something to having won and proven that you can do it for a team, so could help them.
Last thing I want to talk about for ball this week before we get into your recent experience at the theater. CJ Abrams, man. Oh my God.
Yeah.
They sent him down to AAA, sent to the minors. Everybody was kind of like, what the hell? What are you doing? That is one of your best players. Why are you sending him to the minors? Turns out he was out all night at a casino until 8 a.m. in Chicago the day before they had a day game against the Cubs. Did not sleep that night, gambled all night, and then showed up to the stadium on no sleep. And I don't know if he played well in the game. I assume he did not. But on the principle of that, the Washington Nationals said, no, thank you. You can go work whatever you need to work out in AAA because we will not have that here. So, Brody, do you have any thoughts on this other than just like the obvious that stinks? Or
I do, because I saw a lot of people on Twitter, some former baseball players, saying like, if he goes out, you know, whatever, there has to be more to this. You know, like, former players obviously know more about this stuff than we ever could. But like, if you're the Nationals and this is your guy who's supposed to be one of your main stars that you're hoping to be able to market and sell to your fans, is like, this is our guy. You can't have him do this for the optic of having him being out all night and gambling specifically. Baseball and gambling do not get along. So like, no matter what it is, just doesn't look good. And B, this guy was your main return for Juan Soto. If he's out gambling all night, I don't know. It's easy to make the slippery slope argument. I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to say it's a bad optic. And if it was to happen again, and let's say something happened, I don't know, where he was like in trouble or like overslept and missed a game or whatever, it's just an awful look because it reflects poorly on your administration that said that this guy is what we're going to take back for Juan Soto, with obviously James Wood and Mackenzie Gore and whatnot. But like, There's so much that goes into this that's beyond just like, he was out all night. It's like, yeah, it's like that. You can't be out all night, but also you're supposed to be the superstar player of a team that desperately needs you to be the superstar player, because they're also on a track where they're hoping to be able to compete in like a year or two, and they actually have some pieces to be able to do that, and you are a big part of that, and you can't be jeopardizing that by being out at a casino till 8 a.m. That's just dumb. So hopefully it turns them around and it fixes him. That being said, in the last 2 weeks, he's hit almost 400. So maybe it hadn't been affecting him too much. I don't know. Not to go back on everything I just said. Still can't have that. Still can't be doing that. Team should, make sure their star is in good shape.
Yeah, it's a case of just like process over results here. It's like, yeah, you're still hitting well, but we're not going to have that. And it's a lot easier to make this move when you are not in playoff contention and it is late September. Don't know how.
Oh, if they were in a playoff push, he would be going nowhere.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my god, no. Davey Martinez would be at the craps table with him tomorrow morning. It would not be punishing him at all.
No. Yeah, no, you said it. Yeah. I think that's going to do it for us on baseball this week. We will be back, like we said, next week to talk about however the bracket shakes out, what we think it's going to look like, and then just, of course, how we did on our predictions for this 2024 Major League Baseball season. I'd like to switch gears here, though. Brody, you just saw A Different Man, a movie that came out this week that you actually worked on a couple years ago. And I'd love to hear all about your experience with this film, you know, both on the set, in the theater, watching it, and, you know, just like what it was like going from one to the other and seeing, you know, the final product that you helped build on a big screen, and just what that experience was like for you.
It was really cool. And I'm glad that I get to talk about it, because it was really cool, man. It was, so I really put a lot into that movie. Like, I was actually the only member of the set dressing crew, the art department, to make it from day one to the end, make it all the way through. I was the only one who worked on it the entire time. Everybody else either got fired or quit. And so I made it through as the only swing to make it from day one on set to the end product. And I'm very proud of that, because I had my fingerprints all over a couple sets on this movie. And there was a really weird, eerie feeling of watching a movie in a place that you know is not real and yet have been in. Like, if you're watching any movie, like anything that is, you know, come out where there's a scene in an apartment that isn't like somewhere famous. Like if it's not like in Grand Central or something, if it's like someone's apartment, a character's apartment, you've never been there because it's not a real place. There was a moment where they had this scene where they were slowly revealing what was in this room. And I was like, I know exactly what's in there. I put what's in there there. And like, you know, I also took a lot of stuff from the set afterwards that was going to get thrown away. So I was also like, there's my pillow. There's like my girlfriend's coffee table. Like, you know, my painting on the wall. But it was just this weird feeling of being like, I was there. Like I also watched them film a lot. Like I was the on-set dresser a few days. So I got to watch them actually shoot, some scenes. That was really cool. I was looking for scenes that eventually ended up getting cut. So that was kind of fun. Like thinking about where those would have fit and, you know, being like I was like, you know, explaining to Bryce, you know, like what, oh, there's this one scene where they're like, you know, this and this happens. And then like it, you know, they cut it. Like there was a dream sequence scene that I thought that I might actually appear in for a split second as a silhouette and from the back, but got cut, whatever, not hurt by it. It's fine. It was just cool. It was like, it was a really kind of different way to watch a movie. And it was also, I found myself kind of balancing the feeling of like knowing what was going on for the scenes that I was there for and really getting lost in the story and lost, like immersed in the world for the ones that I did not see shot, because I didn't really know what the movie was even about, to be honest, while I was working on it. I only saw like what I worked on and I didn't get to see the whole thing. I saw a lot. But from what I didn't get to see, the scenes that were taking place in the places that I never was, I was really into, because like the movie is very good, first of all. And second of all, I was like, man, this is like, I'm invested in this because I felt such a connection to the other places and the other, you know, and the characters, because I watched, you know, all these things happen like in front of me. It was cool. It was just a cool experience, and I'm glad that I got to do that. And then I actually was recording when I saw my name pop up in the credits, so I have that audio. So honestly, I was more excited than I thought I was even gonna be. It was just really, really cool.
Oh, dude, yeah, absolutely. I'd love to hear that. Could you talk a little bit about like what the film is like about and like what you thought it was about, like when you were...
It's funny. Okay. If you've seen the movie,
fair,
you know,
enough.
Why that's funny.
No pun intended. yeah. But did the final product like differ from what you thought you were making? And then of course, like, what are your thoughts on the final product and how it actually came out?
Based on the like the sets that I spent a lot of time in, which if you go see the movie, I spent a lot of time in the bar, the karaoke bar, the apartment. I spent a ton of time in that apartment, in the apartment building. My fingerprints are over that entire apartment set. There's some fun stuff that if you do see the movie and you want to, like, we could go back through, there's like fun little production stuff that I can mention of like, oh, this was actually this room. And like, there's a scene where I'll just say like, there's a neighbor whose apartment that he goes into. Later on, they show the other neighbor's apartment, and his apartment is actually her apartment. Like, it's hard to explain, but the production stuff was, it was, they got creative. It was kind of fun. It was cool to like know that also, just because like it's, you know, it's a little thing that I was enjoying being able to watch. And yeah, I didn't really know what the movie was about. I knew it was like there was something with his, you know, it was a facial disfigurement, and there's a lot about identity. And I actually wrote a whole review, which if you want me to read real quick, I can do that as well. But yeah. There's a moment in the movie where there's a character who talks about Adam Pearson's face. And Adam Pearson is a disfigurement advocate. You know, he does a lot with people who have a similar disease and just like getting his face out there and trying to make people comfortable with something that they're uncomfortable with, because it's, you know, it can be uncomforting or discomforting when you see his face for the first time, honestly. And there's a scene at like where there's a conversation between two characters that directly mirror conversations that I would hear or had on set around him. And it was like, and it's played for a laugh, honestly. And it makes sense. I actually got to talk to him a lot when I was on set. He's very cool, very funny. And I saw him actually, believe it or not, when I was in London getting on the plane back to New York, he was on, like in the gate that we were getting on the plane, he walked by and I was like going to wave to him. He was heading to the city for the premiere. That was just kind of a weird little coincidence. But yeah, it was, It was weird not knowing what exactly the movie was about and then going to see it and being like, oh, I see how this plays into. But it was cool. But real quick, my review is as follows. A Different Man is a refreshing take on identity. It's not preachy, it's not ham-fisted, and it's not annoying. Its dramatic elements are intertwined perfectly with its comedic relief, and you'll walk away thinking about your appearance and how it's affected your life, for better or worse, or both. A nostalgic noir soundtrack underscores scenes of old-fashioned practical body horror, while also throwing the audience for a loop with modern storytelling that is partly nihilistic and partly deeply tender. It also throws in some of the best situational comedy I've seen in a movie in a long time. It also uses New York perfectly in that... it just exists within it without romanticizing it, much in the way it treats its disabled characters. I'd give it an 8 out of 10. Yeah, its usage of New York is amazing because it just has like these scenes that are so perfectly New York without being like, oh, only in New York. You know, it's like, it's just, you have to see it. Hilarious. There's a scene with an ice cream truck that I actually was dying laughing in the theater. But yeah, good stuff.
Brody, would you say that New York City is its own character in this movie, maybe?
No! That's why it's perfect. It's actually not. They don't do that. It's not like, oh man, the city's alive. No, it's like, it's just a place where the movie takes place. It's like, it's actually, I love the way they did it. It was great. It was like, actually, it felt like what it feels like to live in the city, which is like, you're just there. It's not like, it's, you know, it's not this big romantic thing where it's like, oh, even the loud sirens are beautiful. It's like, no, fuck that. It's annoying as shit.
The sirens. Like, we don't like those. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that is incredibly refreshing to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Great.
I wouldn't even like. They don't talk about the fact that it's in the city. It's like it just, you know, it is because it is. It's
sure.
Like, it's good stuff.
I'm very much looking forward to seeing this movie. I have not been able to see it yet. But yeah, no, I'm really glad that you got this experience, both to work on the movie and to see something that you worked on in a theater, and of course to see your name in the credits of that movie. Just a cool really feeling. Really cool thing all around. Any final thoughts on A Different Man, or before we let the people go,
yeah,
see
go
it for
see
themselves?
It's cool. It makes you think. It really honestly like stayed with me for a few hours after we walked out. Like it has a cool effect, because like it's not a subject matter that a lot of movies will dive into. A lot of anything really will dive into. It's like, you know, facial disfigurement is not something that you think about often. It's not something that you see very often. And ever since it's like being around Adam Pearson 2 years ago, like it's something that at least I was exposed to. And it's like, having now seen the movie, it really, you know, it sticks with you. It really makes you think. So appreciate that aspect of it. And it was cool. Cool very, to be a cool. part of, and very cool to have a credit, and I'm proud of what we made, honestly. And I played a very, you know, a minor role just in the fact that I was just, you know, literally part of the window dressings, but it's, you know, it's still just cool to feel like I was a part of it, and I appreciate you being interested.
Absolutely, man. Go see A Different Man if you have not already. It is out in theaters now. Incredibly exciting. I am only hearing the best things about this movie, and though I have not seen it yet myself, it is at the very top of my watch list, and I will be getting out to
it
this week.
I'm so glad it's getting reviewed well, too. I wasn't expecting that. I honestly didn't know if it was going to be any good.
Yeah, no, how would you?
I had no clue.
Well, I'm glad to hear that it came out well.
Sebastian Stan is very nice, by the way. I did meet him a couple times. I wanted to just say, it's so, like... on the things that I have worked on in the past, I've gotten to meet, like, I've been very lucky to meet, you know, very cool actors. I met Julie Louis-Dreyfus once. She was extremely nice. Sebastian Stan was extremely nice on set. I was actually at his last little speech that he gave the crew, which, by the way, he gave a speech to the crew thanking us, which that's not a thing that you need to do. And he just said how great of an experience was, and everybody was just, you know, welcoming, and nobody ever complained being in really tight, annoying spaces, and you know, being hot in the city and all those things. And he just he was very appreciative, and he was really cool to be around, and he gives a great performance in this. Worth seeing.
That's awesome, man.
Yeah, good stuff.
Anything else that you've watched recently? Is that it?
But no, I have not seen anything else recently. I've really I was focused on
you've been on the grind, man. I can't blame you. You've been in Europe.
I've been working on
yeah, you've been doing your thing.
Traveling, working.
Personally, I mean, I have one thing that's just been on my mind recently that I watched in preparation for a movie coming out this week that everybody has been talking about for quite some time now, which is Francis Ford Coppola's Megalopolis. Mega film financed, produced by himself, film starring Adam Driver as this character who is attempting to rebuild society for the better. And yeah, I mean, I think it is an incredibly fascinating idea, at least what I know of it. I mean, it by all accounts seems like the kind of thing where there's no sense in even talking about what you think you know until you've seen it, and probably until you've seen it like three times.
Crazy cast.
But yeah, I mean, I'm trying to watch a few Coppola films in preparation for it this week. Like, I mean, I would love to like rewatch the Godfather movies, Apocalypse Now, especially The Godfather. So I haven't seen those, to be honest, in quite some time. I mean, I watched them when I was in like high school, but I haven't actually gone back, sat down and watched it in a while, and I am due to do that. I have seen Apocalypse Now a couple times, but this week I watched One from the Heart, which was on Criterion. It's this like hour and a half musical full of these like neon lights, vibrant colors, and this really like moody, gravelly Tom Waits soundtrack set to like what the characters are doing. And it's so strange to me because it's like it might have worked a little bit better for me if Tom Waits had actually played a character in the movie and like they were singing his lyrics like as the things were actually happening. It's more of like the experience is like watching this very unhappy couple sort of navigate the very like materialistic capitalist like world of Las Vegas. They're like meeting people that they just don't connect with really until halfway through the movie, where everything turns on a dime and they sort of meet people who they're more enthused by. But like a lot of the first half of the movie, you're just watching these people sort of be like miserable, be like alone or by themselves, sort of like in arguments. And you're hearing like Tom Waits sing very like low energy, like I said, just very gravelly, almost like swing
Waitsian
music. Yeah. Where, yeah, I mean, if you know Tom Waits, I mean, he's a very singular musician. But the movie has a reputation as being like the one that killed Coppola's reputation and is one of the most like notorious flops of all time, particularly because he went the same route that he did making the movie that we're about to see this week, where he like financed it himself and he did everything the way that he wanted to do it.
Can I just read the premise on Wikipedia for Megalopolis, because it is intriguing?
Yeah, do it.
Okay. In a decaying I'm going to put on my movie voice. Hold on. In a decaying metropolis called New Rome, idealist architect Caesar Catalina is granted a license by the federal government to demolish and rebuild the city as a sustainable utopia using Megalon, a material that can give him the power to control space and time. His nemesis, Mayor Franklin Cicero, remains committed to a regressive status quo. Torn between them is Franklin's socialite daughter and Caesar's love interest, Julia, who, tired of the influence she inherited, searches for her life's meaning.
Are you not sold?
Insane.
That's awesome. That's so cool.
Insane.
Yeah, dude. I'm so excited to watch it. We got to do an episode on this.
Building material that can control space and time.
Yeah,
fun stuff. That's interesting.
We're gonna talk about this movie, no doubt, at length on the pod. I mean, we're coming up to a very exciting time of year where we're getting the baseball playoffs, award season, and we're also starting to see. Yeah, we got football coming up.
I'd
love to start talking about football and hoops more often. I'd like to expand our horizons a little bit. But and of course, we're starting to see actually good movies come out again, because like Tony and I said on the last episode, it has been dry for the past few months.
I feel like there's a lot Deadpool coming out right now, so it's kind of fun. God. This is like a good it's a good time of year.
Absolutely. We've got so much coming up. We're going to get back into the swing, I think, of trying to get this out every week. I know it's been kind of more of like a bi-weekly thing recently for us, but
like
we're getting to
dual monthly.
Yeah. We're getting to the part of the year where it's time to really ramp up and make stuff happen and really talk about some of these fascinating things that are all around the world for us to see.
Hell yeah.
But yeah, until then, I think that's going to wrap it up for us this week. If you haven't already, please go sign up for the Mudville Patreon. You can access that at patreon.com/Mudville. You can find out anytime that we put out an episode, whether it's on the main feed or Mudville at the movies, or now that we got football back, I think we're going to go back to the Staub Brothers New York Sports Show as well. So
we are trying to figure that out. We have a wedding soon. We're going away, and then after that we are going to really try to get that out soon.
Gears are ramping up is what we're trying to get to you.
They're starting to turn. The cobwebs are getting blown off.
Yeah, but you know, back to the topic, on the Mudville Patreon I also post my prospect rankings. I think we're going to do some like award predictions, or just get those all written out, to have those just in some sort of like written form. I think it's good to have that, if just for your records on what you got right and what you got wrong. So a lot of fun on the pod, a lot of fun on the Patreon. You can access all of that for free if you want at patreon.com/Mudville. If you do choose to throw us a few bucks, we would greatly appreciate that as well. I think that's going to do it for us this week. This has been the Mudville Podcast. I've had a great time talking with you this week. Brody, go see Brody's first on-screen credit in A Different Man right now. Film just came out.
Go see it. Let me know what you think. Yeah. Let us know what you think.
But until then, I have been one of your hosts, Nolan Rabine.
I've been your other host, Brody Staub.
And we will see you next time.